Unit 10. Text 1. Straight A Illiteracy by James P. Degnan. Text. Despite all the current fuss and bother about the extraordinary number of ordinary illiterates who overpopulate our schools, small attention has been given to another kind of illiterate, an illiterate whose plight is, in many ways, more important because he is more influential. This illiterate may, as often as not, be a university president, but he is typically a PhD, a successful professor and textbook author. The person to whom I refer is the straight-A illiterate, and the following is written in an attempt to give him equal time with his widely publicized counterpart. The scene is my office, and I am at work, doing what must be done if one is to assist in the cure of a disease that, over the years, I have come to call straight-A illiteracy. I am interrogating, I am cross-examining, I am prying and probing for the meaning of a student's paper. The student is a college senior with a straight-A average, an extremely bright, highly articulate student who has just been awarded a coveted fellowship to one of the nation's outstanding graduate schools. He and I have been at this, have been going over his paper sentence by sentence, word by word, for an hour. The choice of exogenous variables in relation to multicollinearity, I hear myself reading from his paper, is contingent upon the derivations of certain multiple correlation coefficients. I pause to catch my breath. Now, that statement, I address the student, whom I shall call allegorically Mr. Bright, that statement, Mr. Bright, what on earth does it mean? Mr. Bright, his brow furrowed, tries mightily. Finally, with both of us combining our linguistic and imaginative resources, finally, after what seems another hour, we decode it. We decide exactly what it is that Mr. Bright is trying to say. What he really wants to say, which is, supply determines demand. Over the past decade or so, I have known many students like him, many college seniors suffering from Bright's disease. It attacks the best minds and gradually destroys the critical faculties, making it impossible for the sufferer to detect gibberish in his own writing or in that of others. During the years of higher education, it grows worse, reaching its terminal stage, typically, when its victim receives his Ph.D. Obviously, the victim of Bright's disease is no ordinary illiterate. He would never turn in a paper with misspellings or errors in punctuation. He would never use a double negative or the word irregardless. Nevertheless, he is illiterate in the worst way. He is incapable of saying in writing simply and clearly what he means. The ordinary illiterate, perhaps providentially, protected from college and graduate school, might say, "Them people down at the shop better stock up on what our customers need, or we ain't gonna be in business long." Not our man, taking his cue from years of higher education, years of reading the textbooks and professional journals that are the major sources of his affliction, he writes, "The focus of concentration must rest upon objectives centered around the knowledge of customer areas so that a sophisticated awareness of those areas can serve as an entrepreneurial filter to screen what is relevant from what is irrelevant to future commitments." For writing such gibberish, he is awarded straight A's on his paper. Both samples quoted above were taken from papers that received A's, and the opportunity to move inexorably toward his fellowship and eventual Ph.D. As I have suggested, the major cause of such illiteracy is the stuff the textbooks and professional journals the straight A illiterate is forced to read during his years of higher education. He learns to write gibberish by reading it and by being taught to admire it as profundity. If he is majoring in sociology, he must grapple with such journals as the American Sociological Review, journals bulging with barbarous jargon such as ego-integrative, action orientation, and orientation toward improvement of the gratificational deprivation balance of the actor, the latter of which monstrous phrases represents, to quote Malcolm Cowley, the socialist's way of saying, the pleasure principle. In such journals, Mr. Cowley reminds us, two things are never described as being alike. They are homologous or isomorphic, nor are things simply different. In such journals, writers never divide anything. They dichotomize or bifurcate things.
Text 2, The Qualities of Good Writing by Jacqueline Burke. Even before you set out, you come prepared by instinct and intuition to make certain judgments about what is good. Take the following familiar sentence, for example. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. Do you suppose this thought of Patrick Henry's would have come ringing down through the centuries if he had expressed this sentiment not in one tight rhythmical sentence, but as follows? It will be difficult, if not impossible, to predict on the basis of my limited information as to the predilections of the public what the citizenry at large will regard as action commensurate with the present provocation, but after arduous consideration, I personally feel so intensely and irrevocably committed to the position of social, political, and economic independence that rather than submit to foreign and despotic control, which is anathema to me, I will make the ultimate sacrifice of which humanity is capable under the aegis of personal honour, ideological conviction, and existential commitment. I will sacrifice my own mortal existence. How does this rambling, high-flown paraphrase measure up to the bold, give me liberty or give me death? Who will deny that something is happening in Patrick Henry's rousing challenge that not only fails to happen in the paraphrase, but is actually negated there? Would you bear with this long-winded, pompous speaker to the end? If you were to judge this statement strictly on its rhetoric, its choice and arrangement of words, you might aptly call it more boring than brave. Perhaps a plainer version will work better. Liberty is a very important thing for a person to have. Most people, at least, the people I've talked to, or that other people have told me about, know this, and therefore are very anxious to preserve their liberty. Of course, I can't be absolutely sure about what other folks are going to do in this present crisis, what with all these threats and everything, but I've made up my mind that I'm going to fight because liberty is really a very important thing to me, at least that's the way I feel about it. This flat, homely prose, weighted down with what Flaubert called fatty deposits, is grammatical enough. As in the pompous paraphrase, every verb agrees with its subject, every comma is in its proper place. Nonetheless, it lacks the qualities that make a statement of one sentence or 100 pages, pungent, vital, moving, memorable. Let us isolate these qualities and describe them briefly. The first quality of good writing is economy. In an appropriately slender volume entitled The Elements of Style, authors William Shrunk and E.B. White stated concisely the case for economy. A sentence should contain no unnecessary words, a paragraph no unnecessary sentences, for the same reason that a drawing should have no unnecessary lines and a machine no unnecessary parts. This requires not that the writer make all his sentences short or that he avoid all detail, but that every word tell. In other words, economical writing is efficient and aesthetically satisfying. While it makes a minimum demand on the energy and patience of readers, it returns to them a maximum of sharply compressed meaning. You should accept this as your basic responsibility as a writer, that you inflict no unnecessary words on your readers, just as a dentist inflicts no unnecessary pain, a lawyer no unnecessary risk. Economical writing avoids strain and at the same time promotes pleasure by producing a sense of form and right proportion, a sense of words that fit the ideas that they embody. With not a line of deadwood to dull the reader's attention, not an extra, useless phrase to clog the free flow of ideas, one following swiftly and clearly upon another. Another basic quality of good writing is simplicity. Here again, this does not require that you make all your sentences prime-alike or that you reduce complexities to bare bone, but rather that you avoid embellishment or embroidery. The natural, unpretentious style is best. But paradoxically, simplicity or naturalness does not come naturally. By the time we are old enough to write, most of us have grown so self-conscious that we stiffen, sometimes to the point of rigidity, when we are called upon to make a statement in speech or in writing. It is easy to offer the kindly advice, be yourself, but many people do not feel like themselves when they take a pencil in hand or sit down at a typewriter. Thus, during the early days of the Second World War, when air raids were feared in New York City and blackouts were instituted, an anonymous writer, probably a young civil service worker at City Hall, produced and distributed to stores throughout the city the following poster. Illumination is required to be extinguished on these premises after nightfall. What this meant, of course, was simply, lights out after dark. But apparently that direct imperative, clear and to the point, did not sound official enough. So the writer resorted to long Latinate words and involved syntax, note the awkward passives, is required and to be extinguished, to establish a tone of dignity and authority. In contrast, how beautifully simple are the words of the translators of the King James Version of the Bible, who felt no need for flourish, flamboyance, or grandiloquence. The Lord did not loftily or bombastically proclaim that universal illumination was required to be instantaneously installed. Simply, but majestically, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. Most memorable declarations have been spare and direct. Abraham Lincoln and John Kennedy seemed to speak to each other across the span of a century, notes French author André Moreau, for both men embodied noble themes in eloquently simple terms. Said Lincoln in his second inaugural address, "With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in." 100 years later, President Kennedy made his inaugural dedication. "With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judgment of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love." A third fundamental element of good writing is clarity. Some people question whether it is always possible to be clear. After all, certain ideas are inherently complicated and inescapably difficult. True enough. But the responsible writer recognizes that writing should not add to the complications, nor increase the difficulty. It should not set up an additional roadblock to understanding. Indeed, the German philosopher Wittgenstein went so far as to say that whatever can be said clearly. If you understand your own idea and want to convey it to others, you are obliged to render it in clear, orderly, readable, understandable prose, else why bother writing it in the first place? Actually, obscure writers are usually confused, uncertain of what they want to say or what they mean. They have not yet completed that process of thinking through and reasoning into the heart of the subject. Suffice it is to say here that, whatever the topic, whatever the occasion, expository writing should be readable, informative, and wherever possible, engaging. At its best, it may even be poetic. As Nikos Kazantzakis suggests in Zorba the Greek, where he draws an analogy between good prose and a beautiful landscape, "To my mind, the Cretan countryside resembled good prose, carefully ordered, sober, free from superfluous ornament, powerful and restrained. It expressed all that was necessary with the greatest economy. It had no flippancy nor artifice about it. It said what it had to say with a manly austerity. But between the severe lines, one could discern an unexpected sensitiveness and tenderness. In the sheltered hollows, the lemon and orange trees perfumed the air, and from the vastness of the sea emanated an inexhaustible poetry. Even in technical writing, where the range of styles is necessarily limited, and poetry is neither possible nor appropriate, you must always be aware of the reader over your shoulder. Take such topics as how to follow postal regulations for overseas mail, how to change oil in an engine, how to produce aspirin from salicylic acid. Here are technical expository descriptions that defy a memorable turn of phrase. Here is writing that is of necessity cut and dried, dispassionate and bloodless. But it need not be difficult, tedious, confusing, or dull to those who want to find out about mailing letters, changing oil or making aspirin. Those who seek such information should have reasonably easy access to it, which means that written instruction should be clear, simple, spare, direct, and most of all, human. For no matter how technical a subject, all writing is done for human beings by human beings. Writing, in other words, like language itself, is strictly human enterprise. Machines may stamp letters, measure oil, and convert acids, but only human beings talk and write about these procedures so that other human beings may better understand them. It is always appropriate, therefore, to be human in one's statement. Part of this humanity must stem from your sense of who your readers are. You must assume a rhetorical stance. Indeed, this is a fundamental principle of rhetoric. Nothing should ever be written in a vacuum. You should identify your audience, hypothetical or real, so that you may speak to them in an appropriate voice. A student, for example, should never just write without visualizing a definite group of readers, fellow students perhaps, or the educated community at large, intelligent non-specialists. Without such definite readers in mind, you cannot assume a suitable and appropriate relationship to your material, your purpose, and your audience. A proper rhetorical stance, in other words, requires that you have an active sense of the following. 1. Who you are as a writer. 2. Who your readers are. 3. Why you are addressing them and on what occasion. 4. Your relationship to your subject matter. 5. How you want your readers to relate to the subject matter.
Listening in and speaking out. The Transaction by William Zinser. About 10 years ago, a school in Connecticut held a day devoted to the arts, and I was asked if I would come and talk about writing as a vocation. When I arrived, I found a second speaker had been invited. Dr. Brock, as I'll call him, a surgeon who had recently begun to write and had sold some stories to national magazines. He was going to talk about writing as an avocation. That made us a panel, and we sat down to face a crowd of student newspaper editors, English teachers, and parents, all eager to learn the secrets of our glamorous work. Dr. Brock was dressed in a bright red jacket, looking vaguely bohemian, as authors are supposed to look, and the first question went to him. What was it like to be a writer? He said it was tremendous fun. Coming home from an arduous day at the hospital, he would go straight to his yellow notebook and write his tensions away. The words just flowed. It was easy. I then said that writing wasn't easy and it wasn't fun. It was hard and lonely, and the words seldom just flowed. Next, Dr. Brock was asked if it was important to rewrite. Absolutely not, he said. Let it all hang out, and whatever form the sentences take will reflect the writer as is most natural. I then said that rewriting is the essence of writing. I pointed out that professional writers rewrite their sentences repeatedly and then rewrite what they have rewritten. I mentioned that E.B. White and James Thurber rewrote their pieces 8 or 9 times. What do you do on days when it isn't going well? Dr. Brock was asked. He said he just stopped writing and put the work aside for a day when it would go better. I then said that the professional writer must establish a daily schedule and stick to it. I said that writing is a craft, not an art, and that the man who runs away from his craft because he lacks inspiration is fooling himself. He is also going broke. What if you're feeling depressed or unhappy? A student asked him. Won't that affect your writing? Probably it will, Dr. Brock replied. Go fishing. Take a walk. Probably it won't, I said. If your job is to write every day, you learn to do it like any other job. A student asked if we found it useful to circulate in the literary world. Dr. Brock said that he was greatly enjoying his new life as a man of letters, and he told several stories of being taken to lunch by his publisher and his agent at fashionable Manhattan restaurants where writers and editors gather. I said that professional writers are solitary drudges who seldom see other writers. Do you put symbolism in your writing? A student asked me. Not if I can help it, I replied. I have an unbroken record of missing the deeper meaning in any story, play, or movie. And as for dance and mime, I have never had even a remote notion of what is being conveyed. I love symbols, Dr. Brock exclaimed, and he described with enthusiasm the joys of weaving them through his work. So the morning went, and it was a revelation to all of us. At the end, Dr. Brock told me he was enormously interested in my answers. It had never occurred to him that writing could be hard. I told him I was just as interested in his answers. It had never occurred to me that writing could be easy. Maybe I should take up surgery on the side. As for the students, anyone might think we left them bewildered. But in fact, we probably gave them a broader glimpse of the writing process than if only one of us had talked. For, of course, there isn't any right way to do such intensely personal work. There are all kinds of writers and all kinds of methods, and any method that helps people to say what they want to say is the right method for them.